everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. Excuse me. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. That's authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA and their upcoming writers conference this July 16th to the 19th at SeaTac Hilton in right outside Seattle. I'll be there, actually, teaching a couple different things. Particularly Sunday, I'll be doing a two-hour workshop on confidence, on finding your confidence, finding and keeping your confidence. So if you want to learn more about that, go to pnwa.org. I think there's still plenty of room if you want to sign up. I will be at the Chuckanut Writers Conference next week from the 26th to the 27th up in Bellingham, Washington. So if you're up there, stop by and say hello. And I should say, on July 1st at East West Books in Seattle, I'll be teaching a class, No One is Broken. This is for parents of kids on the spectrum. I'll be offering a spiritual perspective on the unique challenges of being a parent of kids on the spectrum. So if you're interested in that, you can either go to my website, williamknauer.com, or to East West Books and sign up for it there. Or just show up and sign up on the night of. It's July 1st at East West Books in Seattle. So if you're a regular listener to this show, you have probably noticed that I'm as likely to interview life coaches and spiritual teachers as I am memoirists and novelists. And that's because I think that the challenges facing a creative person, whether writer or otherwise, have very little to do with craft and everything to do with our relationship to our creativity, to the source of our creativity, whether you call that your muse or your imagination or source energy or God, whatever your word for it. And that's why I'm so glad to have today with me Sunita Patani, who's written The Transcendent Mind, The Missing Piece in Emotional Well-Being. Now, Sunita's a psychotherapist and author based in East London who specializes in exploring the link between mind, body, spirit, and emotional healing. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today. Sunita, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill.
So, Sunita, this book, actually, you know, this, it's funny. This book is your second, and your first was called My Secret Affair with Chocolate Cake, The Emotional Eater's Guide to Breaking Free. And now, of course, from there, you made the natural transition to A Course in Miracles. So how did this book come about?
Okay, so The Transcendent Mind came about because, you quite rightly said, actually, my first book was My Secret Affair with Chocolate Cake. And actually, that came about from me suffering quite badly from an eating disorder. And so as I went on the journey of personal development, it all started off with myself, really. Then came the first book, out of everything that I'd learned. And then I trained to become a psychotherapist, because originally, actually, I was a teacher. So I trained to become a psychotherapist. And I actually was a maths and science teacher.
Oh, you came from the right brain. Okay, the left brain. Okay.
I was. That was partially why, actually, I got the eating disorder when I look back retrospectively now. I was too left, you know. So, and really, when I set up my private practice, Bill, what actually happened was that I started noticing that the conventional techniques that I'd been taught were successful to some extent, but there were some people that, you know, were not benefiting. And at first I thought it was me, that, you know, okay, well, I'm a new therapist, perhaps I need to work on my skill set. But then I started noticing that people were coming in and they'd been to other therapists in the past. So then I thought, well, isn't that interesting? It can't all, you know, can't all be me. And that's really when I started reading around the subject, so outside of the box, so to speak, you know. And that's really when I came across A Course in Miracles, and I read the Bhagavad Gita. And it went from there, and that sort of transpired. Then I started looking into academic research, and then came along the Transcendent Mind.
Yeah, it's a fascinating that this was your path to the work you're doing now. Because I don't know if you're familiar, but A Course in Miracles was written by a psychologist in 1970 who was unhappy with what was going on with her and her partner, and she thought there's got to be a better way, and that was where that book came from. All right, so you needed something more, and the Transcendent Mind looks beyond. It looks beyond the realm of the five senses, and it looks beyond the realm of sort of, in a way, rational, what we would normally term rational thought for solutions to emotional challenges. Would you say that's a fair description?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that really what the Transcendent Mind is about at the very core is, in traditional therapy, you see, Bill, you know, we sort of look at, we have the person-centered approach, which is building trust and, you know, really getting to know the person, a lot of listening, a lot of paraphrasing, you know, there's a good place for that. You, of course, have the psychodynamic, which is looking at the person's past, and then you have the behavioral skills. So you're looking at things like cognitive behavioral therapy, for example.
Yeah.
But what I discovered when I started reading The Course in Miracles and the Bhagavad Gita was that there was one mind. You know, I came across the concept of there being a singular consciousness, a one mind, and that we were actually individual expressions of this singular consciousness. And so what happened, the next natural question, me being very left-brained, that I asked myself was, well, if this is true, where can I go to validate this? You know, where is there validation for this? And that's really when I started looking into the idea of near-death experiences. And at the time, I didn't realize that near-death experiences is actually an academic area of study.
Yeah,
so
it is now.
So I started reading and, you know, it was quite a revelation, actually. And I really started looking at the different case studies and what people were saying, the experiences that people had had. And as I started to put the pieces of the jigsaw together, so to speak, out emerged was the idea of, yes, this transcendent mind, this singular consciousness that connected us all. And actually, at the very core, that's what we are. So you're quite right when you're saying that, you know, it goes beyond the five senses. It goes into the realm of you know, pure consciousness, so to speak, which is what I believe we are at the core.
Yeah, it's tricky for the poor rational mind. And I think, I don't remember what chapter it was, but in Ulysses, I forget which chapter it is, that Stephen Dedalus is sitting on the beach, and it begins with the phrase, the ineluctable modality of the visible and the ineluctable modality of the audible. And what he means is, when you listen and see the world, everything is broken into separate little parts. Into, you know, the modality is different modes, different separate pieces. And so our physical world and the rational mind is breaking everything into pieces. And so the leap to the transcendent mind that you're talking about, the sort of oneness, is beyond that, because it's saying, no, forget the separation. It's a kind of illusion. And we deal in separations. That's how everything, every word is separate, every thought is separate, our fingers are separate, everything is separate. But the transcendent mind asks you to reverse that perception.
Absolutely. You know, I'm guessing it asks you to not only reverse, but actually it asks you to sort of understand or to maybe consider the notion that actually separateness and togetherness are sort of two sides of the same coin, that actually they exist as one. And I know that sounds kind of bizarre. It's like a dichotomy. You know, I mean, you're quite right. You know, I mean, like I was saying, I'm in UK and it's 10 p.m. here and I'm in my bedroom at the moment, actually. And, you know, and you're quite right. You know, if I'm looking here, I can see separateness. I can see a mirror. I can see the wardrobes. I can see the carpet. I can see the bed. But actually, I can also see, if I look really carefully, the transcendence, because if I look at the wardrobe, where is it, you know, where exactly does the wardrobe stop being a wardrobe? So, you know, you have the wardrobe and it's joined to the carpet, and the carpet is joined to oxygen. The oxygen is joined to the bed. The bed is joined to the carpet on the other side. It's joined to the wall. You get the gist. So, you know, if you really look carefully, actually everything is connected. It just looks separate. You know, but there actually is interconnectedness everywhere.
Yeah, we need it to be separate to make sense of. Have you ever read A Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor?
I've not. No, actually, I should check that out.
Well, it's great. If you want to just make it easy on yourself, you can Google her TED Talk. But she's a Harvard brain psychologist who lost the left side of her brain through a stroke. So she could only deal in the sort of receptive, not the narrative. She lost that narrative part of her brain that broke things into pieces so it could be understood. And as she was losing the use of that left side of her brain, the world began to blur, and she couldn't tell where her, as she was trying to dial 911, she couldn't see where her hand ended and the phone began, because that was simply a function of her left brain translating all that energetic information into pieces, which they actually weren't. Do you understand?
Absolutely, yeah.
It was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating.
It sounds,
all right, so
it.
You started
sounds
with
it.
Near-death experiences. You started with that. And so what, and why there first? I mean, I can guess why, but for you, that was, why did you begin there? Because there was something tangible, something you could read about? What led you there first?
I think it was really, you know, so when I'd read A Course in Miracles and I'd read the Bhagavad Gita, and I thought, again, it came back to this idea of this, you know, this one consciousness. And the left brain in me was very much like, again, you know, where can I go to validate? So near-death experiences, the reason it was so compelling for me is because it answered the question of what is there beyond our five physical senses, and is there anything beyond our five physical senses? So as I started to look into that, you know, it was more the anecdotal evidence that people were coming back and they were talking about the fact that, you know, that actually we're eternal and there is no life and there is no death, and or some of them experienced a oneness, you know, with everything whilst they're consciousness had left the body. So for me, this area was a very, very important area to look at, because it was validating the idea that, number one, there was more to us than just the physical body and the sensory perception that we have. And number two, the idea of, well, you know, who are we at the very core? Because let's face it, Bill, you know, I don't think that we can actually heal completely unless we really start to ask the question of, who am I?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree 100%. And I think that because unless you know what you are at your core, then you're just sort of noodling with the externals. You're just sort of shifting
exactly. The
pieces around. But this must have been tough for you. So I went through something similar as my sort of spiritual life took shape. I hadn't come as much from the science and math background. I came as an artist, so my relationship to the sort of non-physical was more intuitive, because the imagination, and you can't touch it, see it, smell it, measure it, you know, and that was sort of my tool. But it was still tough, you know. I believed in, you prove things. It's nothing's true unless you can prove it. And even near-death experiences, it's still a story someone's telling you about a place that no one else that only they have been to. And so that must have been tough for the part of you that was so rooted in not wanting to appear stupid, not wanting to appear gullible. Did you have to deal with that emotionally at all?
It's really interesting what you're saying. And, you know, funnily enough, no, which is quite odd, actually, because I tell you what was really strange. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I remember very vividly thinking the question, I actually remember sitting there, and the question was that, I wonder what would happen if the earth blew up or if there was no universe. Now, for a 5 or 6 year old to be contemplating that was kind of mind-boggling, you know. But the point I'm getting at is that from that young age, there was something within me that was asking the bigger questions of life. So the funny thing is that although actually I was very rational, and although I was very, you know, left brain, so to speak, I am Indian by culture. And in our, whether you say culture or religion, whatever you want to call it, I guess we kind of grow up with God is very much, the Eastern philosophy and God is very much a part of our upbringing. So I think very naturally there was always that sort of inclination within me that, yeah, okay, there's a God, and when you die, you don't actually die, because that's what we'd grown up with, if that makes sense, you know.
Yeah, sure.
It was almost like second nature. So there was like a split side to me. You know, there was my mathematical side, but then there was also then an inherent knowing that actually I think there is more to us that meets the eye than just the, you know, just the body. So when I did start to look at near-death experiences, funnily enough, I didn't actually have any problem comprehending or believing them. In fact, when I read them, it was just validation, I guess, of something that I already knew existed, although I'd never come across it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I love the near-death experiences because one of the things I've come to understand, especially as I've interviewed, well, just through my own life, period, and then through all the conversations I've had with memoirists who are often writing about death, the death of a loved one or their own sometimes near-death experiences, or perhaps they've come close to dying because of disease and so on. The more I've thought about this and talked to people about this, the more I've come to the conclusion that the story, and this is really true about Course in Miracles because it deals with this constantly, but the story you tell yourself about death sort of becomes the story you tell yourself about life, because whether you think death is extinction or a continuation will in many ways determine how you live your life up to that moment.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
And, you know, I think this is really one of the key things that I have put forward in my own therapeutic practice, that actually, you know how many people, Bill, I get coming in who are very conflicted about the idea of death, and it causes them a lot of grief because
sure.
They're very conflicted. They don't know necessarily what happens. Now, I always say to people, look, I don't know. I can't say to you for certain because I've not had a near-death experience, but I have an inner knowingness that I think this is the truth, you know, intuition-wise. And they come in and they're very conflicted. And, you know, you're right, because when a person believes that there is nothing more than the physical body and that when death will come, there will be nothing after that, it almost takes away the purpose of life. You know, what is
it
the
does.
Point? What is the point of of living? What is the point of goodness? What is the point of doing anything if at the end of it, you know, it's going to be nothing, there's no continuation? So I think what you're saying is very right. When there's light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, it gives you purpose for what you're here to do here and now.
Well, not only, yeah, absolutely, and not only that, but if death is the extinction, your whole life becomes about simply not dying. It's not about living.
Yep.
It's simply about forestalling, and it becomes, death is the end to every story in terms of your physical experience. That's going to be the end. And when you write a story, if you write a novel or a memoir, the end is what the story is about. That's what the story is about. That's where it's going. And so whatever you think about that moment, that's going to determine everything. It was a big deal for me when I finally kind of made the switch, but I couldn't live with the thought that it's extinction. It just made life impossible to me. I didn't know how to live life that way.
It does, Completely agree. Yeah.
All right, so now you've begun, so obviously you've brought this point of view into your practice. Have you enjoyed the practice more now that you've brought the sort of spirit, not the sort of, but you've brought the spiritual to the psychotherapeutic?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm very mindful with the way that I bring this into practice because it very much depends on every client that comes in. But what's really wonderful is that I know that I have a whole array of additional tools open to me, you know. And so when people tend to come in, I will sort of gauge within the first couple of sessions. One of the things that I always tend to ask them is, do you have any spiritual belief? You know, and that quite often is a good sort of opener to see where the person is, that, you know, do they believe in a higher power or not? And if not is the case, that's absolutely fine as well. But, you know, if need be and if there is reason to, then I usually will introduce some of the academic stuff to them, like the parapsychological findings or the near-death experience findings, which can sometimes just help to get a person thinking in a different way, you know? So, yeah, I would say, you know, clinic has become very fulfilling, so it's good.
That's good. And I assume that your own understanding of it has deepened. I mean, because I think that research is a place to begin, but in the end, the true understanding of it has to come through just through you and
Absolutely.
Your life. Yeah?
Yeah, and I think that is really what it does come down to. And it's amazing, isn't it? Because when we have a look at like the Newtonian approach to science, it's supposedly very objective, looking at facts. But, you know, I think ultimately, Bill, when you break it down, you know, a lot of this comes down to our own subjective experience and what it is that we're experiencing within. So you're quite right. And, you know, one of the things that I will always say is that the client is only going to go as far as what or where the therapist has been themselves. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This is just my personal opinion. I don't think it matters how well read you are, how many letters you have behind your name, how qualified you may be. Ultimately, yeah. I don't think it matters, because what matters is, where are you as a person? You could be the most qualified person but not have a deep inner connection to yourself, and you are not going to be able to help a client to a greater degree. You know, that's just my personal opinion. You know, how defined you are is really what you can't give what you haven't got at the end of the day.
No, it's absolutely true. I hadn't thought about that, but I think you're absolutely right. How far into it do you want to go? It can be a little scary. I was just writing about that this morning, because, you know, one of the challenges of dealing with life of dealing with well-being as unconditional, which is what we're talking about, it's not, your well-being is not tied to any of the things that you have or don't have, or that it's unconditional, is that it's seen as a kind of threat in a way, because only by keeping your eyes on conditions can you keep yourself safe from those conditions which can supposedly harm you, unless they can't harm you, in which case, do you understand what I'm saying? In which case, you have to take your eyes off of them. So it's a kind of a taking your hand off the rail that maybe doesn't exist to find your balance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit paradoxical, isn't it?
It is.
You know, but no, I absolutely agree. I agree with what you're saying. You know, it's different perspective on things and just getting a deeper understanding about who you are and really, you know, what role your environment plays as well. So many things to consider, but actually it's very simple at the same time. You know, it's completely paradoxical. So I agree with what you're saying.
It is, but you have no choice but to, well, anyway, if you want to go in deep, you've got to be willing to reframe things. In fact, you were talking about, I forget what you were talking about earlier. I was thinking about facts as they relate to, I was just reading this in a Course in Miracles the other day, and I loved it. They said, look, you can't argue with facts, but everything is simply interpretation of facts. This is the hard, like, yes, the war exists. That's the fact. But what is your interpretation of that fact? That becomes the reality, not the fact itself.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really doing is
exactly.
Telling people different stories.
Exactly. It is about looking at your perception, you know, looking at how you're perceiving things and what meaning really you're giving to whatever it is that you're perceiving. And it's interesting, actually, you talk about the concept of war, because, you know, when you have a look at some of the, let's say, Holocaust survivors, for example, you know, you will find that although there was much, much suffering, but, you know, a small handful of the survivors have sort of come forward and said, well, I understood that when I was, you know, going through that experience of being within the Holocaust, that actually my freedom was my own according to my thought system. So no matter what atrocities I was enduring on the external side, outside of me, nobody could actually come away and change my thought that, in fact, I had power over what I was thinking, you know, and really using their thought system and changing and bringing compassion into it or radical acceptance into it. You know, so the idea of our perception is very, very powerful. And I think that when we really work on building ourselves and really, you know, work on the obstacles that we face in life, as we begin to change perceptions, it can really be life-transforming, you know?
I've known it in my own life, and I see it in so many. I teach memoir writing a lot, and often what the students have come to write is stories about they've gone through some travail, and they've come out the other side of it, and they're trying to go look back at the suffering of whatever happened to them, and reframe it as the thing that taught them who they were, not as this thing done to them. But, I mean, even the case of the Holocaust survivors, as awful as, obviously, as sort of nightmarish as concentration camps are, if they came out knowing this a deep understanding of freedom, I don't know how they wouldn't – I would never want to give that up. And it seems unthinkable, but they'd have to give up their freedom, too. I think I have time for one. There's one caller here who would like to ask you a question. I think we have time for it. Let's see. Jeffrey, if that's you.
It is myself, Bill. How are you?
I'm fabulous. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. And I'd love to tell people that I'm going to the Chuck and Nut Writers Conference with you, and good luck with that, my friend.
Thank you.
What a great name. Congratulations on the release of The Transcendent Mind, The Missing Piece of Emotional Well-Being, Sunita. Wonderful book.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're very welcome. My question to you is, you've written on your exceptional blog that Maslow is perhaps best known for his hierarchy of needs. However, not many people speak about his notion of peak experiences. Could you please describe to me what a peak experience is?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, Jeffrey. So Maslow, you know, quite correctly what you've said, you know, a lot of people talk about hierarchy, but peak experiences actually were first of all termed mystical experiences, I should mention. And it's the experience of the having oneness. It's like it's described as a psychological, well, I would call it a psycho-spiritual state, actually, of experiencing oneness with everything around you. So, you know, for a split second or, you know, a few minutes, you'll just have the experience that you're absolutely one with everything. And in that moment, you know who you are. It's outside the boundaries of time and space. It's outside your, you know, your sensory perception. It's just an absolute one knowingness. In fact, if you're familiar with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, the founder, Edgar Mitchell, actually had what we would describe as a peak experience when he did his journey as an astronaut. And it was when they were coming back, I think, on the way back, he had the window seat. And you'll read about this in my book, actually. He had the window seat and he'd seen planet Earth. And in the split second of how the planets had lined up, he had that peak experience, which lasted around about 3 days. So that's what Maslow, and in fact, you know, Maslow wrote a whole book on this called, I think it's Values, Religion, Values, and Peak Experiences. It's a very small book, but he's actually written lots of good number of case studies within that book. So you might want to check that out.
What's the name of the book again?
I think it's Religion, Values, and Peak Experiences.
Okay.
By Abraham Maslow.
Yeah.
Peak
That's awesome. Well,
yeah.
Sunita, this has been a fabulous conversation. I'm so glad you came on. Now, so that again, the name of the, before I get to my last question, the name of the book is The Transcendent Mind, The Missing Piece and Emotional Well-Being. And again, if people go to sunitapatani.com, that's sunitapatani.com, they can download one of the chapters for free to get a little taste of what the whole book is like. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, you get a whole set of 7 tools. So it is very, it's very practical. So if anybody wants to go away and actually practice how to get in touch with the transcendent mind, it's all there.
That's excellent. Okay. All right. My last question then, Sunita. Because writing is a bit of a mystical experience, if you ask me. At least it is for me, a lot of the people I know. So finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
It has taught me how to be one with life, because that's the way that I express my creativity.
You learned it there, did you?
I did indeed. That's how I get into the zone and become one with life or God. So it's my mystical experience. It's how I transcend.
Yeah. Well, for many of us as well. That's awesome. Well, Sunita, thank you so much. This has been a true pleasure.
The pleasure's been all mine. Thank you so much, Bill.
You're welcome. Yes, it's true. What she's talking about, for you writers, who, if you haven't put the pieces together, is that experience when you enter the sort of dream of writing, and it's the flow, and you lose track of time, and you're not paying attention to the past, and you're not paying attention to the future. It's just a sort of meditative state, and you lose track of time, and you're flowing along, and it feels great. That's what she's talking about. And if it's going well, it happens every time. So little did you know you were having a transcendent experience when you were writing your suspense novel. All right, well, listen, I will be back again next week, and I'm going to be talking to Stephanie Kallos. Wonderful Stephanie Kallos. I can't wait to talk to her about her new book, Language Arts. Until then, go do something you love. can't hurt.